Welcome to today's reading of the Midland Reporter Telegram and the Odessa American, read by volunteers and staff. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand at recordinglibrary.org.
This is Dave, and I'm reading from the Midland Reporter Telegram, Wednesday, November 9th. This is Section A, the front page. The headline reads, MISD, no evidence of CRT programs. Murray, teaching of CRT is not something that is planned, I can assure you of that. By Stuart Doreen. Programs involving the teaching of critical race theory, or CRT, are not allowed in Texas public schools, including Midland Independent School District, according to Interim Superintendent Kelly Spencer. It's essentially part of legislation that the teaching of CRT cannot be implemented in public schools, Spencer said, and we have no evidence to suggest that it's happening anywhere inside Midland ISD. CRT was a topic of the school board races and public comments delivered during two meetings about what the public wanted to see in the next superintendent. Community members stated they didn't want CRT taught inside Midland ISD as part of social and emotional learning opportunities that take place regularly inside MISD. There weren't any MISD school board candidates this election cycle in support of going against Texas law. In fact, two candidates changed their campaign messaging from saying teaching CRT was against the law to telling potential voters they would work to keep it out of Midland ISD schools to avoid any confusion. There is not a member of the MISD school board that would support CRT, Board President Brian Murray said. It is the same of candidates coming in. Murray said that with 3,000 employees, there is always a chance that someone can speak out of turn. But state law forbids that it can be taught, and that the teaching of CRT is not something that is planned, I can assure you of that. Two programs that have received attention are Character Strong and Achieve 3000. According to MISD, Character Strong is a research-based curriculum for social and emotional learning. Social and emotional learning is an intentional focus in schools to make sure students have access to supports to be well and acquire life skills such as goal setting, responsible decision making, and regulating emotions and resolving conflict. Character education is skills to be civic-minded, socially responsible, healthy, and kind, the district stated. According to the district, Achieve 3000 is a supplemental resource for reading for grades 7 to 10. At San Jacinto, it is also provided to 6th graders. It provides nonfiction passages for students to read based upon their reading level and asks them questions about the text. Each passage is categorized by grade level and reading level. I do think there's some misinformation out there, Spencer said, and we've looked at some of the things that people are sharing. And so, there are people associated with the development of some of those curriculums that may have written articles or such about social justice or social justice reform. But that isn't an aspect of the curriculum itself. Spencer said Achieve 3000 is based on current events. And so it is. It is possible that there could be an article on social justice or something that's happened in the world that people would see. But it isn't associated with CRT. District officials have previously stated there are opportunities for student opt-out and parental involvement with Character Strong and Achieve 3000 programs. The district's policy for opting out aligns with Section 26.010 of the Texas Education Code, which provides that a parent is entitled to remove the parent's child temporarily from a class or other school activity that conflicts with the parent's religious or moral beliefs, the district reported. However, the statute does not allow a parent to opt out to prevent the child from taking a subject for an entire semester. About parental review, the district stated parents can create an account at characterstrong.com/family-welcome-link to view the material for 30 days. If they do not wish to create an account, they can come to school and view it on an administrator's computer or observe the lesson in school, MISD stated. In regard to Achievement 3000, parents can log into the program using their students' credentials at any time to see the materials. Parents can review digital and printed instructional materials at sites.google.com/midlandisd.net/instructional-materials. This is a follow-up to the last article. It is called Frequently Asked Questions about Character Strong and Achieve 3000 Programs. How often do students take Character Strong? According to the district, the curriculum at the elementary level is incorporated into morning routines, such as morning announcements. Some campuses also incorporate it into their PE and arts classes. There is not a specific Character Strong class. At the junior high and high school level, the curriculum is provided during advisory period. Some campuses take one day of the week to do the whole lesson. Others take 15 minutes each day, according to the district. How often do students take Achieve 3000? It is used one time a week in English classes and twice a month in social studies and science classes, according to the district. When was Character Strong selected? Why was this material selected? Character Strong was approved by the board in November 2021, according to MISD. The material was selected as a strategy to comply with the TEKS requirement to provide instruction in positive character traits and personal skills. Does Character Strong include instruction on gender, race, or sexual orientation? MISD says no. When was Achieve 3000 selected? Why was this material selected? It has been in use since 2019 and renewed annually, most recently in June 2022, according to the school district. It was selected to provide supplemental, textbook-aligned nonfiction reading content for students. It is formatted to prepare students for STAR 2.0 informational text sections and the writing component for science and social studies. This article is entitled, MISD to Consider Hiring More Police Officers. Murray. How board district address discipline is potentially a bigger issue. By Stuart Doreen. Midland ISD has dealt with fights, disturbances uploaded to social media, and even threats made to other students, staff, or campuses in general. The issue has plagued not only Midland ISD, but Ector County ISD in Odessa. Midland ISD Interim Superintendent Kelly Spencer said recent events and the overall bid for greater school/student safety measures have caused districts across the state to evaluate how they are structured. I don't know that the answer is more police officers necessarily, but I do believe that there does need to be an increase in security staff, and maybe the answer is police officers, Spencer said. Maybe the answer is security guards. Maybe the answer is a mixture of both. Spencer told the Reporter Telegram that currently Midland ISD has 16 police officers, including 2 canine officers, 1 for each high school. She added, there is a security guard at Coleman High School and MISD Police Department leadership for a staff total of 20. Midland ISD Board President Brian Murray said the district will discuss security concerns before the creation of the next budget and determine proper number of police officers, security staff. He also said how the board and district addresses discipline issues is potentially a bigger issue. He said, Midland ISD is dealing with the lack of growth socially in students during the COVID pandemic, including the threats being made at campuses like Alamo Junior High this week. The concern about staff numbers and what type of a presence is appropriate on campuses across the district was heightened after instances at Legacy Freshman High School forced Midland ISD School Board member Michael Booker and City Councilman John Norman to hold community meeting in September. It was there that concerned community members weighed in on the safety concerns at the freshman high school. That is something we're evaluating to make sure that we have staff on campuses, security staff or police staff on campuses, in the event that something were to happen, said Spencer, who added that when the district is short a policeman, that it can cause coverage issues. And so we need to make sure that campuses are covered at all times, specifically the secondary campuses, where most likely we might see an incident happen. We don't have the solution yet. We just know that it is something that we need to address. Ector County ISD reported this week they have 32 licensed officers. 31 are full-time. This article is entitled, RRC Leaders Fine-Tune Infrastructure Weatherization Rules. Amendments provide more certainty on definition of energy emergency. By Mella McEwen. Cold weather is flowing across the U.S., and while it hasn't yet reached Texas, state agencies continue preparations demanded in the aftermath of Winter Storm Uri in February 2021. At the November 1st open meeting, Texas's three railroad commissioners approved proposed amendments to statewide Rule 3.65 regarding designation of critical infrastructure as required by legislation passed after the storm. Those amendments, which had been published in the Texas Register for Public Comment, include more clearly defining when there is potential for firm load shed, providing more certainty on the definition of energy emergency. Secondly, gas wells producing an average of 250 MCF or less a day, and oil leases producing an average of 500 MCF or less per day, are excluded from the list of critical gas suppliers. A third amendment exempts a facility not designated critical from having to file Form CI-D, while those facilities designated critical aren't eligible for an exemption. PBPA members greatly appreciate the efforts to ensure that natural gas operators can continue to have access to power, unlike during the 2021 winter storm, so that it can continue to produce this vital commodity during times of weather emergencies, Ben Shepard, president of the Permian Basin Petroleum Association, told the Reporter Telegram by email. The commission, he wrote, has done its job in reviewing its rules to ensure they are responsive to the feedback that they receive, and we appreciate the work of the entire agency to adopt changes that reflect our growing understanding of the natural gas supply chain. It is clear from just this last winter that natural gas producers have taken steps to ensure they are operating during winter weather like we are used to out in the Permian Basin. Shepard added, while not addressed in this rulemaking because that is the responsibility of the Public Utilities Commission, we also know that electric generators must continue to undertake greater efforts to build reliable thermal assets, create new storage for natural gas, and purchase their needed fuels in advance to ensure that their failures do not occur again moving forward. The amendments, while progress, still did not go far enough to address concerns, according to Commission Shift, the statewide organization seeking to improve the agency's function, transparency, and accountability. Newly adopted SWR 3.66 requires critical natural gas facilities on the state's electricity supply chain map to weatherize those facilities, based on facility-specific factors, to ensure sustained operations during a weather emergency, and to correct known issues that caused weather-related stoppages before December 1st. Natural gas demand is constantly changing because Texas's energy needs are constantly changing, Virginia Palacios, executive director, said at the meeting. The critical infrastructure rule must not only address that variability, but the RRC's critical infrastructure division must also develop systems and processes to regularly compare projected gas demand against the supply that can be produced from facilities designated as critical that are also subject to the weatherization rule. She said it needs to be made clearer that connection to electricity is not the only means of weatherizing a gas supply chain facility, and facilities that are not connected to the grid should still be required to implement weather preparedness measures. She said another key vulnerability is when operators transfer critical assets, but their contact information remains on the electricity supply chain map until the next filing deadline, meaning former operators will be responsible for transferring emergency calls to the new owners in event of a weather emergency, possibly for up to 6 months. It is not enough for the Railroad Commission to continue to operate through trial and error, Palacios said. The Commission must graduate from being a reactive bureaucracy to taking a proactive approach to public safety and stewardship of natural resources and the environment. This article is entitled MPD Seeks Details in 2009 Cold Case by Mercedes Cordero. Midland Crime Stoppers is offering a cash reward for any information that can help solve a 2009 homicide cold case. On October 6, 2009, James Thomas, also known by his street name Sidewalk, was found deceased inside a pickup by a passing motorist. Thomas, 45, was found at about 6:42 a.m. slumped over the steering wheel of a red 2007 Dodge pickup, covered in blood, on the North Service Road of the 4300 block of West Wall and Midland Drive. During the investigation, it was determined that Thomas died of his injuries. With little information to go on, the case was closed, according to the Facebook post. Thomas was known to frequent motels around the West Wall Street area and hung out on the southeast side of Midland. If a person has any information that helps with the investigation, he or she will be eligible for a $2,500 cash reward. Call Midland Crime Stoppers at 694-TIPS or download the Crime Stoppers app, P3 Tips, and submit an anonymous mobile tip. No caller ID is ever used, and those providing information will remain anonymous. Reference MPD case number 09100-6008. This is the Business and Oil page. This article is entitled Diamondback Reports $1.2 Billion Profit by Kyra Buckley, Houston Chronicle. High oil and gas prices helped lift Diamondback Energy's profits and revenues in the third quarter as the world continues to face an energy crunch stemming from pandemic recovery and Russia's February invasion of Ukraine. The Midland-based independent oil and gas company said Tuesday profits surged more than 80% to $1.2 billion in the three-month period ended September 30th, compared with $649 million during the same time frame in 2021. Revenues rose just over 25% to $2.4 billion from $1.9 billion in the third quarter last year. The third quarter was another solid quarter for Diamondback, the company's CEO Travis Stice told investors. We focused on cost control, working to mitigate inflationary pressures associated with the variable components of our cost structure through improved operational techniques. Supply chain issues, partially stemming from uneven pandemic recovery and Russia's war against Ukraine, along with inflation, have made it challenging for oil and gas producers to get needed equipment. Diamondback's revenues increased on high oil prices. However, production dipped slightly compared to the third quarter of last year. The company, which primarily operates in the prolific Permian Basin of West Texas and New Mexico, reported average production of 390,600 barrels of oil and gas per day, compared with 404,300 during the same period last year. During the quarter, the company also announced it would buy fellow Permian operator Firebird Energy for $1.6 billion. That deal is expected to close by the end of this month. This article is entitled, U.S. Shale Boom May Have Peaked for Good, by Sheila Tobin, Bloomberg. The U.S. slashed its forecast for the nation's oil production growth next year, predicting that output will fall short of an all-time high, in the latest sign that the shale boom may have peaked for good. America's crude production is now estimated to hit 12.31 million barrels a day in 2023, a fifth straight downward revision, according to monthly data from the Energy Information Administration. Up until the agency's latest report, released Tuesday, output in the new year was expected to surpass the record 12.315 million barrels a day reached in 2019. It's one of the many indications that production from shale fields, one of the world's few sources of major oil output growth in recent years, is slowing and will never rebound to pre-pandemic highs. That's a blow to the global market, which needs U.S. barrels to help make up for OPEC's production cuts and supplies upended by Russia's invasion of Ukraine. The forecast is also the last thing President Joe Biden wants to see as voters head to the polls in crucial midterm elections that will determine control of the House and Senate. The administration's desperate push to tame pump prices, including threats of a windfall tax on oil producers' profits, has repeatedly sown mistrust and stoked tensions with the fossil fuel industry. Oil supply increases in 2023 will be limited by labor shortages, high equipment costs, and supply chain constraints, the chief executive officer of Permian producer EOG Resources, Inc. said last week. His comments echoed ConocoPhillips CEO Ryan Lance's recent warnings about narrow U.S. production growth next year. Producers have largely adhered to pledges of spending discipline, only raising output modestly despite oil prices hovering around $90 a barrel, as investors demand higher returns and as expenses surge for labor, equipment, and raw materials. Capital discipline will be the main constraint on production, said Hunter Kornfiend, an oil market analyst at Rapidan Energy Group. There is risk to the downside due to inflationary pressure and more so capital discipline. I don't see that this will subside next year. This article is entitled, OPEC Plus Cuts That Steadied Market Now Bring Risk of $100 Crude, by Grant Smith, Bloomberg. Oil's rise toward $100 a barrel is exposing some of the risks in OPEC Plus's controversial production cuts. For about a month, the group's decision appeared to fulfill its stated aim of stabilizing oil markets, with crude prices steadying against a deteriorating backdrop for fuel demand. Now, at the midpoint between the October 5th OPEC Plus meeting and the group's next gathering in December, prices have moved close to triple digits again as the seasonal demand peak threatens to coincide with additional sanctions on Russian supplies. I think OPEC Plus is super happy with stabilizing Brent in the $90, said Helga Andre Martensen, senior analyst at DNB Bank in Oslo. But there is a real risk of over-tightening in the next 3 to 5 months. Brent rose to a two-month high of $99.56 a barrel on Monday before pairing gains. The January futures contract retreated 0.5% to $97.39 a barrel as of 12:35 p.m. in London on Tuesday. The run-up in prices, just as the U.S. votes in midterm elections, threatens to further inflame relations between Joe Biden and Saudi Arabia, the cartel's de facto leader. The president has fiercely criticized the kingdom for the supply curbs, accusing the longtime American ally of abetting fellow OPEC Plus member Russia in its war on Ukraine. In the weeks following the decision by the Organization of Petroleum Exporting Countries and its allies to cut output by 2 million barrels a day, the political fallout was intense. But initial trends in crude prices and demand gave some vindication to the strategy, which was spearheaded by Saudi Energy Minister Prince Abdulaziz bin Salman. Oil demand has proved to be significantly lower than expectations, according to Russell Hardy, chief executive of Vitol Group, the world's biggest independent crude trader. Demand in China, the world's biggest oil importer, is unlikely to recover from strict pandemic lockdowns until the second half of 2023, Hardy said in a Bloomberg television interview. "We're in a world where demand is sloshing downward," said Ed Morse, head of commodities research at Citigroup. "There's ample supply in the market. Instead of the potential shortage that was being predicted a few months ago, global markets now faced a surplus this quarter," according to OPEC Secretary General Haytham Al-Gayus. "Price differentials in key Asian markets have deteriorated as China reconfirmed its tough anti-COVID measures." This article is entitled "U.S. Heating Cost Forecast Nearly Doubles" by Chunzi Zhu, Bloomberg. U.S. consumers who rely on heating oil for warmth this winter can expect to pay 45% more than last winter, according to the latest estimate from the Energy Information Administration. Last month, the government projected U.S. heating costs would be 27% higher compared with the previous winter. Fuel supplies are estimated to have fallen to the lowest level for the end of October since 1951, prompting the EIA to raise its price forecast, the report said. In the U.S. Northeast, where more people burn heating oil than anywhere else in the country, stockpiles are a third of typical levels. The scarcity has prompted some suppliers to ration fuel to avoid panic buying. The Biden administration last week allotted $4.5 billion for the Low-Income Energy Assistance Program to help cover home heating costs this winter. Household heating oil expenditures are expected to average about $2,350 this winter, which would be the highest since 2013-14, when adjusted for inflation, the EIA said. This column is called Q3 Earnings Snapshot, from the Associated Press. Diamondback Energy. Midland. Diamondback Energy Inc., FANG, on Monday reported third-quarter net income of $1.18 billion. On a per-share basis, the Midland-based company said it had profit of $6.72. Earnings, adjusted for non-recurring gains, came to $6.48 per share. The results missed Wall Street expectations. The average estimate of 13 analysts surveyed by Zacks Investment Research was for earnings of $6.51 per share. The energy exploration and production company posted revenue of $2.44 billion in the period, topping Street forecasts. 11 analysts surveyed by Zacks expected $2.38 billion. Viper Energy Partners, Midland. Viper Energy Partners LP, VNOM, on Monday reported third-quarter net income of $79.3 million. The Midland-based company said it had net income of $1.06 per share. Earnings, adjusted for non-recurring gains, were 98 cents per share. The results topped Wall Street expectations. The average estimate of 7 analysts surveyed by Zacks Investment Research was for earnings of 40 cents per share. The oil and gas company posted revenue of $221.6 million in the period, which also topped Street forecasts. 7 analysts surveyed by Zacks expected $213.7 million. This is the Business and Oil page. This article is entitled Biden's feud with big oil intensifying. World Needs More Oil from United States by Kevin Crowley, Jennifer A. DeLuey, and Ari Natter, Bloomberg News. As October drew to a close, the White House saw another potential energy flashpoint on the horizon. Diesel and heating oil inventories in the Northeast were getting worryingly low. Officials swung into action, organizing a series of calls between Energy Secretary Jennifer Granholm and several of the country's biggest oil refiners to discuss strategies to boost stockpiles. The tone was cordial, according to people with knowledge of the conversations. But the very next day, the oil industry was blindsided. At a hastily arranged press conference on October 31st, President Joe Biden castigated big oil for handing outrageous profits to shareholders and executives rather than bringing down prices at the pump. Unless that changed, he warned, oil companies faced more taxes. Their profits are a windfall of war, the windfall from the brutal conflict that's ravaging Ukraine and hurting tens of millions of people around the globe, he said. It was just the kind of whiplash that has repeatedly sown mistrust and stoked tensions with the fossil fuel industry over the course of the Biden administration, according to multiple interviews with executives and lobbyists involved in oil and gas, who declined to be identified because the meetings and conversations they described were private. Biden's team has been at odds with the industry since the 2020 election campaign. But as global energy prices spiked this year following Russia's invasion of Ukraine, the White House called on big oil to help, only to grow increasingly frustrated that it's holding back on production while reaping record earnings. Month after month, these companies have posted record profits that they've then used to pad shareholder pockets rather than boost production and lower gas prices, said White House spokesman Abdullah Hassan. Month after month, we've offered them every opportunity and incentive to change their behavior. While they were never under any illusions about the president's green ambitions, oil industry insiders say they've become increasingly unhappy with a series of conflicting policy priorities. For example, moving within a matter of months from a halt on federal leasing for oil drilling to demanding more production, and unrealistic requests such as spending billions of dollars to rapidly add more refining capacity. Unwilling to act as fall guys for surging household fuel bills in the run-up to the midterm elections, typically low-profile industry figures are becoming more outspoken. Last week, the chief executive officers of ExxonMobil Corporation and Chevron Corporation issued grave warnings about potential windfall taxes. Marshall McRae, co-CEO of pipeline operator Energy Transfer LP, said this week that U.S. energy policy is so all over the map that it's becoming like, quote, a Saturday Night Live skit, unquote. It'd be funny if it wasn't so tragically sad, he added. For its part, the administration says it has approved 9,000 drilling permits, released 180 million barrels of oil from the Strategic Petroleum Reserve, and essentially provided a floor under the oil price with a commitment to repurchase crude at $70 a barrel. If they don't like the carrots approach, the president has made clear we can use sticks too, Hassan said. We will do what we need to do to support American families. The tensions come at a fraught moment for both the country and the rest of the world. President Vladimir Putin's weaponization of Russia's natural gas has left Europe facing a perilous winter. OPEC has been unwilling to ease a tight oil market. Instead, last month, it defied U.S. wishes by agreeing with Russia to reduce output. Recent history shows the U.S. can play a vital role in ramping up oil production to ease prices and provide energy security. After all, the shale revolution added more crude to global markets than the entire production of Iraq and Iran combined from 2012 to 2020, making the U.S. the biggest producer of both oil and gas. But to repeat that growth spurt again would require the right investor and policy support, as well as balancing increasingly ambitious U.S. climate goals. So far, the signs of that happening aren't good. A lot of senior executives are kind of throwing in the towel with this White House, said Stephen Brown, an energy consultant who formerly served as head of federal affairs for Refiner Andeavor. When we talk to folks inside the administration, we hear things that are conciliatory toward establishing a relationship. And then you turn around and get hit between the eyes with a tweet. On January 20, 2020, his first day in office, Biden revoked a presidential permit for the Keystone XL pipeline, which would have allowed more Canadian crude to flow to Gulf Coast refineries. Days later, he issued a moratorium on new federal oil and gas leasing, later overturned in court. Executives in the shale patch were infuriated, as some of the best well locations in the Permian Basin are on federal land in New Mexico. The message was clear. Biden and his progressive caucus would be no friend to the oil industry. As gasoline crossed the $3 a gallon threshold in the middle of 2021, senior figures in the administration began paying more attention, not only to the prices at the pump, but also their role in pushing up inflation. A critical moment came in November last year, when Biden accused the industry of, quote, anti-consumer, unquote, behavior, and complained that gasoline prices remained high, even though oil and gas companies' costs are declining. Biden asked the Federal Trade Commission to investigate potential illegal conduct. The trust between industry and the administration has likely been deteriorating ever since, said Frank Macchiarola, Senior Vice President of Policy at the American Petroleum Institute, a group representing the energy industry. There's a lack of understanding of fundamentals of energy markets. By the time Russia invaded Ukraine in February, causing oil to spike to its highest since 2008, the White House had completed an about-turn from the earliest days of the presidency and was demanding the production of more oil and gas rather than policies to curtail output. We are on a war footing, Granholm told executives assembled for the CERA Week by S&P Global Oil Conference in Houston in March. But U.S. producers, still battle-scarred from the height of the pandemic when energy prices collapsed, were in no mood to cooperate. After a decade of poor returns for investors, a consensus had emerged on how to restore confidence in stock prices, hold production flat, and return as much cash as possible to shareholders. As inflation surged in the first half of 2022, it became clear that the White House had an economic crisis on its hands. No U.S. president has been reelected with gasoline prices above $4 a gallon. In June, the nationwide average touched $5. As analysts began pricing in record profits for big oil, Biden went on the attack. We're going to make sure everyone knows Exxon's profits, he said at a press conference in Los Angeles. Exxon, start investing and start paying your taxes. Thanks. Exxon responded by saying it was investing heavily in the U.S., and was working on a major Gulf Coast refinery expansion. But the narrative was now clear. Biden would be blaming big oil for high gasoline prices. Less than 2 weeks later, Biden summoned top oil executives to the Department of Energy in Washington to discuss the issue. For more than an hour, the CEOs talked with Granholm about the barriers to higher fuel production and the policy moves that could help pare costs. Granholm assured them that the administration wanted to collaborate. At one point, Wirth, the Chevron CEO, walked through the economics, logistics, and constraints of U.S. refining. Participants described the meeting as cordial and productive, a kind of olive branch offered to the industry after Biden's tongue-lashing. But it was a much different scene 3 months later when oil company officials met again with Granholm, National Economic Council Director Brian Deese, and Amos Hochstein, a senior energy advisor at the State Department. The September 30th session, initially expected to take an hour and build as a discussion of fuel supplies in the wake of Hurricanes Fiona and Ian, quickly devolved. There was little talk of the storms. One participant described it as a lecture from Granholm. Administration officials berated the group for selling fuel overseas instead of storing more in U.S. tanks, and suggested that without voluntary industry action, the government could force companies to stockpile more domestically. At least one official blasted the companies for reaping high profits while failing to address low inventories. As Granholm and Hochstein pressed the companies to curtail fuel exports and explained how they would work to lower prices, the industry participants repeatedly raised objections, insisting they couldn't divulge those details in front of competitors. That kind of frank discussion could be a violation of U.S. antitrust law, they argued. The meeting broke up less than half an hour after it began. Tensions between the U.S. fossil fuel industry and a Democratic president were probably always to be expected. But the current clashes between both sides have been far more visible than when Barack Obama was president.
Hello, my name is Thoris, and I'm reading the Odessa American for Wednesday, November the 9th, 2022. Red wave hits commissioner's court. Ector County rode a red wave and ended election day with an all-Republican commissioner's court. It looks like that will hold in Texas as Governor Greg Abbott won his third term as the head of the Lone Star State over challenger Democrat Beto O'Rourke by about 800,000 votes. In Ector County, few races needed election day as most were unopposed or decided during the March primary. The Justice of the Peace for Precinct 3 ended the night about 9:30 p.m. with Republican Bill Bowen defeating Democrat Gerardo Arzate, 3,886 to 1,773, or 68.67% to 31.33%. Bowen defeated Freddie Redmond and Dudley Graham during the Republican primary in March. Arzate ran unopposed in the Democratic primary in March. In the Commissioner Precinct 4 contest, Democrat Savannah Morales, who bested longtime incumbent Armando Rodriguez during March's primary, lost to Republican Billy Hall, 2,066 to 1,618, or 56.08% to 43.92%. A total of 25,590 votes were cast out of 83,521 registered Ector County voters. In early voting, 14,545 voted in Ector County. Also, the Ector County Utility District Board of Directors positions were on the ballot. Troy Walker and Sheila Black were the top vote-getters, with Walker at 1,444 and Black at 958 to fill the two open seats. Will Kapfoff got 767 votes. U.S. Representative August Pfluger of District 11 was not contested Tuesday, but was in Odessa and Midland campaigning on Tuesday with wife Camille. Unopposed candidates who were declared elected include Republican Kevin Sparks as state senator for District 31, Republican Brooks Landgraf, state representative for District 81, Republican W. Stacy Trotter as the justice in the 11th Court of Appeals, Republican Den Whalen as the 70th district judge. Also, Republican Lori Ruiz Kirchner as the 244th district judge. Republican John Schrode as the 358th district judge. Republican Dustin Fawcett as the Ector County judge, Republican Brooke Hendricks as the county court at law, Republican Christopher Clark as the county court at law too, Republican Lee McClendon as the Ector County attorney, Republican Carissa Webster as the Ector County district clerk, Republican Jennifer Martin as the Ector County clerk, Republican Cleopatra Calloway as the Ector County treasurer, Republican Greg Simmons as the Ector County commissioner for Precinct 2, Republican Terry Lang as Justice of the Peace for Precinct 1, Republican Missy Walden as the Justice of the Peace for Precinct 2, and Democrat Elizabeth Baez for Justice of the Peace for Precinct 4. Notable statewide elections included the race for governor, lieutenant governor, attorney general, comptroller of public accounts, commissioner of the general land office, commissioner of agriculture, and railroad commissioner. Juvenile center trimmed down. On Tuesday morning, the Ector County Commissioner's Court heard from HOK Representative Jeff Bradley about recommendations for eliminating areas for the new juvenile detention center. There were five areas that Bradley recommended that could be eliminated, which included cutting the number of beds from 64 to 32. That would bring the facility cost to about $26 million. Despite reducing 18,000 square feet from the originally planned facility, the project cost is still $1 million over budget. In my mind, you are going to knock a couple million more off of it to get it down below the 25 because you are going to have to change orders and all kinds of things that fluctuate, Ector County Commissioner for Precinct 1, Mike Gardner, said after the meeting. Gardner added, "I'm not willing to bend a whole lot of it." Bradley spoke to the court for about 20 minutes and laid out the cuts that were made from the original plan. The five areas that could be eliminated would be two housing units, Sallyport Vocational Area, and two recreational yards. The youth center, which is currently at 1401 East Yukon Road and has been in that location since 1974, will relocate to 1801 South Crane Avenue and sit to the west of the Ector County Sheriff's Office. After the meeting, Bradley spoke to the Odessa American and said that contractors that didn't initially bid on the project earlier this year approached him about the juvenile detention center. "Contractors called me the last couple of weeks," Bradley said. "They want it." Ector County Youth Center Director Kevin Mann sat in the gallery while Bradley gave his recommendations. Mann said he currently has enough staff to watch over 32 kids. The proposed facility has four separate pods that can house 8 kids each. The proposed facility would be nearly 49,000 square feet. There would also be a separate area for probation, as well as keeping kids who are coming into the facility away from those leaving the facility. "The county hasn't done anything in 50 years, Bradley said. "The types of kids have changed. Their offenses have changed. The environment that they are in isn't conducive to rehabilitation." "The staff does everything that they can with what they have," Gardner said Tuesday, that he believes the court should hold off on making a decision on the juvenile detention center until January, as a new judge and a new commissioner are set to join the court. "From my point of view, I think the court should wait and talk about what we want to do going forward," Gardner said. "I don't know if it would be fair for us to make that decision." Youth center numbers continue to climb. Even before Ector County's kids started being arrested for making threats at local schools, the county's juvenile court system was already seeing a huge jump in the number of kids getting into trouble. According to statistics obtained under the Texas Public Information Act, the number of kids referred to the Ector County Juvenile Court System jumped nearly 46% from September 1, 2021 to August 31, 2022. The probation department saw 151 felony drug referrals in FY22, a 268% jump. But it also recorded slight increases in the number of kids being referred for burglaries and thefts. the catch-all category of other felonies increased from 36 to 61, or 69%. The number of kids being detained at the Ector County Youth Center reached such a high level a couple of weeks ago. Ector County Juvenile Probation Director Kevin Mann said his staff had to reassess the threat level of each one to determine which ones could go home because they had to lower the facility's population. Although the facility can hold 48 juveniles, Mann said he's only comfortable housing 30 kids due to his current staffing levels. The facility reached 32 a couple of weeks ago. The recent spike in kids being detained for threatening fellow students and teachers with violence is not helping matters, Mann said. While most are released after 10 days, they just keep being replaced with other kids who have made threats, he said. 30 is really our cap. That's our limit. If we go over that, you make it unsafe because you're stretching your ratio of staff to kids, Mann said. You get to the 30, you start looking at your numbers saying, gosh dang, man, we're really fixing to make this department unsafe for kids and staff. So you look on there and you find the ones that are less dangerous and you get with the prosecutor, you get with the judge and say, hey, are you okay with us releasing those kids? And that can be a bad practice. But when it's all the staff and the funding you get, what else can you do? Mann also noted that a few weeks ago, his staff was hit hard by COVID-19, something they managed to avoid during the worst days of the pandemic. 8 detention officers out of 40 were out virtually at once. Even though you're still staffed for 30, you still have people call in sick, you have people take vacation, and you have people with doctor's appointments and kids, Mann said. Mann also noted kids who have been sentenced to time in Texas Juvenile Justice Department facilities are having to wait up to 3 months for beds. That's not helping matters either, he said. Mann and his deputy director, Maria Sosa, said last year they saw a lot of juveniles being referred to juvenile probation for vaping THC, the active ingredient in marijuana. But this year they are seeing a lot of kids being arrested for controlled substances in pill form. We don't know where they're getting it from. We just know that we're definitely seeing an increase in those, Sosa said. We've got kids selling it. Not only are they using it, they're selling it, Mann said. They do it on social media. We'll get pictures of them on Snapchat or whatever. Hit me up. Contact me. I've got whatever. In recent days, they've heard about a lot of drug overdoses, too. Fentanyl is a real issue, they say. Parents need to start monitoring their kids' social media accounts and getting otherwise involved in their children's lives, Mann and Sosa agreed. This whole social media thing, man, oh man, these kids network through that. They sell guns, they sell drugs, you name it, and almost everything is funneled through it. It's the easiest way, Mann said. Many of the kids just think drugs and guns are cool, Mann said. That image of, look at me, I carry a gun. I think it goes way back to some stuff just gets so glamorized, and kids are constantly seeing it on their social media feeds or in the music they listen to. They watch television, video games, whatever it is. That's just their lifestyle. You know, that's just, hey, look at me, this is what I do. I'm just like this person on TV, or I'm just like this gangster, whatever it is. Mann and Sosa said it amazes them how many times a probation officer will go into a kid's room and see guns and drugs sitting there in full view on a dresser or TV stand. I think your parenting is different now. I think it's a completely different group of parents from like when we were raised. I lived in my parents' house. That wasn't my room. Like I stayed in that room, but that wasn't my room. That was my parents' house, Mann said. I remember my parents going in. What is this poster on the wall? Take that down. Or what's this or that? I think now parents are just sort of like, whatever he's doing over there, he's doing. We see a lot of parents who are just so removed. Not all parents, but there is a majority that are so removed from what's going on with their kid. They're living their life, and their kids are living their life. Ector County Court at Law Judge Brooke Hendricks, who handles the juvenile docket, said overcrowding in schools and bullying are definitely issues contributing to the rising number in recent weeks. She also agreed with Mann's assessment on parenting. We have parents who are not disciplining their children. treating them like they are the adult in the house and have had zero consequences for their actions, Hendricks said. When they come to court, they do not respect authority, and we do our best to shift that mindset. Every child that comes before me gets the lecture that they are not the boss at school or at home, and certainly not in my courtroom. Guns. Several years ago, a man said law enforcement used to arrest kids for shoplifting at the mall. Nowadays, they are arresting kids for breaking into cars to steal guns. They walk through neighborhoods looking for unlocked car doors, looking specifically for guns. We've seen them on Snapchat saying, "Get a hold of me. I got this gun. I'll sell it." They use their little cryptic words. But you know what they're saying? We've seen that. But they're also arming themselves. There's no doubt, Mann said. Mann is convinced every child can be rehabilitated, but they have a lot of obstacles placed in their path, he said. There aren't enough counselors in the area who can address substance abuse or mental health issues, for one. For another, the kids often don't have the support they need, he said. Kids, at the end of the day, have got to have a proper support system, Mann said. A kid can go away for treatment, but if they come back right into a home where siblings use, or parents use, or their uncle uses, or their peers, then they're going to fall right back into that. We've noticed kids, when they're in a secure environment where their actions every day are controlled, they behave. They're saying the right things. They have a plan, and when they get out, they walk right back out into the street, and it changes. I mean, it's just instant, he said. There are times when they almost wish they can take steps to keep kids inside facilities longer, Mann said. Hendricks said the probation department often has to try to fill the gaps because many of the children do not have the appropriate support system at home. We want these children to know we are here to help them be successful, Hendricks said. The purpose of the juvenile system is to rehabilitate versus punishment. Of course, there will always be children with whom we have exhausted all our resources, or when the case is so heinous, the TJJD is now our only option. Mann said his probation officers do the best they can. We have conversations with the families and the kids. Let's make better decisions. We're constantly in contact with them, calling them every day or going by their house. We do a lot of home visits, school visits, and we're always there to encourage. But at the end of the day, we go home to our families and go to bed. We can't control what's going on outside of our vision, Mann said. New facility. Mann expressed disappointment that with building costs so high, Ector County likely won't be getting the new facility he dreamed of. The county didn't receive any bids for a proposed $25 million facility, with many contractors informally telling county officials they couldn't build it for that price because of skyrocketing costs. As a result, the county intends to go back out to bid with a scaled-down version. The hope had been the new larger facility would address not only safety and privacy concerns, but that it would give staff and volunteers the space they need for new rehabilitative programs for both kids who are waiting to be adjudicated and for those who have already been adjudicated and currently have to be shipped outside the county, Mann said. The proposed facility would have had 64 beds, a multi-purpose room, a gymnasium, several more day rooms, a library, and multiple courtyards with space for a garden. Ector County Judge Debbie Hayes said last week the county will be seeking new bids for a 32-bed facility because the county is also no longer considering bringing post-adjudicated kids back to Ector County to serve their sentences, she said. While the new facility may be smaller than the existing facility, she said it would be better laid out. The need for rehabilitative, vocational, and educational programs is huge, Mann said. According to the latest state statistics, 33% of kids who spend time in TJJD facilities land back into trouble, he said. Many of the kids in the system are suffering from depression, anxiety, PTSD and substance abuse issues, he noted. These kids have witnessed a lot, especially these kids who are always getting into trouble and are always on the streets. They witness violence, they witness abuse, they witness seeing kids overdose, they've seen shootings, or they've been shot at, Mann said. They're always in the fight or flight mode. Always, and they have come out here and they don't trust us. They don't trust the police. They don't trust teachers. They don't trust anybody in authority. And we have to break down those barriers.
We've been reading from the Midland Reporter-Telegram and the Odessa American. Please stay tuned for the weather, followed by the second hour's reading of the newspapers.